I think both sides would like to reach a deal if they could, but the way things have been structured, it's very hard to see how they come together.
Another round of trade talks set between the United States and China. It's Tuesday, July 30th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We invite you to join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo heads to Asia. Accusations of racism in Australia. Chocolate a growing pleasure in India. Steam trains and racing at a snail's pace. It's all on today's VOA Asia. 2 months after U.S.-Chinese talks aimed at ending a tariff war broke down, both sides are set to meet again. The talks have a new venue, the Chinese megacity and financial capital of Shanghai. Both sides of the table have been trying to temper hopes for a breakthrough on an array of disputes that has grown to include tension over China's tech giant Huawei. Rhetoric has hardened despite the June agreement by Presidents Donald Trump and Xi Jinping to revive efforts to end the costly fight over China's technology ambitions and trade surplus. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Phil Levy, who was the senior economist for trade for President George W. Bush's Council on Economic Advisers, what he thought would happen.
I think they're at an impasse. I think both sides would like to reach a deal if they could, but the way things have been structured, it's very hard to see how they come together.
Why do you say that?
I think from China's standpoint, they're willing to make some changes, but not changes to their fundamental economic model. And in return, they want to see the U.S. drop the substantial levels of protection that it's applied. The Trump administration seems to have no interest in dropping the protection, and it's deeply attached to some of these demands, which are non-starters for the Chinese.
Well, it seemed to be that a few months ago there was a deal in the offing. What happened? Who hardened more and why?
You're right. It was in early May. It looked like they were getting ready for a signing ceremony of sorts. China's vice premier was about to come to Washington, and everything seemed set. There was an accusation at the time that China had backtracked on commitments it had made, that it had reneged. Very hard to judge those allegations for two reasons. One, because these negotiations take place in secret, and two, because there are some standard accepted practices, such as people make offers that are contingent on the other side matching. If the other side won't match, then those offers are no longer thought to be valid. That's not usually reneging. In this case, what appears to have happened is China offered to do some things if the U.S. would remove the tariffs. The U.S. said, we don't want to remove the tariffs, so China backed down. Whatever the truth of it was, this led to very hard feelings, and it led to President Trump, on the eve of this meeting, declaring that he was going to put on additional tariffs, which he did. That move, I believe, was intended to increase pressure on the Chinese and make them give in. If that was the intent, it did just the opposite, sort of hardened the Chinese position, convinced them that this was hopeless, and each side retreated to its corner.
Where does this go from here? Where can it go from here?
So there's really three possibilities. One possibility is that they strike this deep, meaningful, structural deal that the Trump administration has been seeking. I think there's essentially zero chance of that happening. The Chinese aren't going to go for it. They don't trust the Trump administration, and we're getting too close to the election, and they'll think they can wait things out. Second possibility is that they strike some kind of a light deal where the Chinese make some concessions, maybe they buy some agricultural products, the U.S. drops some tariffs, and they say, well, we've made progress. Politically, that's hard. Things the Chinese would also want, for example, be getting more of a pass for their big 5G telecommunications firms, and that's raised national security concerns in the U.S. The other possibility is we kind of keep on the trade war path, which is tariffs stay in place or potentially even get worse.
How much of this is politically motivated on either side?
Oh, I think it'd be naive to assume there was no politics at play. China cannot be seen to be kowtowing to the United States in all of this. And the Trump administration has placed a lot of stock in being able to deal with the China issue. They've promised farmers that their suffering won't be for naught, and they certainly want to win. And I'm sure they're aware that there's an election coming up next year. So there's politics all over the place.
How does this affect the rest of the world?
This seems to be having a pretty serious negative effect on the rest of the world, sometimes in surprising ways. You're seeing Europeans, for example, get caught up in this. And I think the U.S.-China trade conflict is posing some big threats to the global trading system. It's calling into question some rules and institutions that we had thought were stable and that we were relying upon. So it's a serious concern.
On the eve of the talks, the Chinese government accused Washington Monday of arrogance and selfishness after President Trump pressed for the World Trade Organization to stop allowing Beijing and other governments to receive more lenient treatment as developing economies. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. North Korea and South China Sea, top agenda as Pompeo heads to Asia. China defends Hong Kong police, blames Western forces. Poverty in Philippines, high for Asia, falls as economy strengthens. 12-year sentence for China dissident on state secrets charge. U.S. and China revive trade talks with low hopes for progress. Expanded coverage of all these stories and a whole lot more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The United States is not ruling out working-level talks with North Korean officials on the sidelines of Southeast Asian regional meetings in Thailand this week, with experts noting Pyongyang's recent missile launch is not likely to reverse Washington's current diplomatic efforts. On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will arrive in Bangkok, where he will co-chair the U.S. Association of Southeast Asian Nations Ministerial. VOA State Department correspondent Nike Ching spoke with State Department spokeswoman Morgan Ortegas about the trip, which she says includes much more than issues related to the South China Sea and North Korea.
Those are two topics that are going to, of course, be a part of our discussions this week. But actually, when you look at our trip in Asia, there's so much to talk about as we go through the region. Of course, there's a litany of issues that we have to deal with China, but there's also relationships that we've had for a long time. Our first stop is in Thailand for ASEAN. And of course, we've been allies with Thailand for 65 years. These are incredibly important relationships. We go then on to Australia, another longtime ally. And of course, we will finally end up in Micronesia, where you have the first time ever a Secretary of State is visiting. You attend my daily briefings, Nike, and we often sort of joke when we're preparing for the daily briefings that it's really a daily Asia briefing, because so much of the portfolio of what the U.S. government is focused on is in East Asia, is in Southeast Asia. So yes, North Korea is certainly an important issue. As we said last week, we continue to push for diplomatic talks and to resolve the situation peacefully. But we, again, do hold a strong line that we are looking for the complete denuclearization of North Korea. And sanctions will remain in effect until both parties believe that that goal has been achieved.
How would you characterize current diplomatic engagement between the U.S. and North Korea? And can we rule in or rule out working-level meetings on the margins of ASEAN?
Well, that's something that we're certainly not going to preview ahead of time. You know, our negotiations with the North Koreans are some of the most sensitive things that we have to do anywhere in the world. So we are clearly going to be continuing to talk to our allies who face this issue quite closely, right? Whether it's North Korea, China, or a litany of issues in Southeast Asia, our allies in the region deal with this on a daily basis. It's in their backyard. So we're certainly going to be working towards a peaceful resolution, and anyone who can help us achieve that goal, we welcome to the process.
South China Sea, mm-hmm. How concerned is the United States regarding recent developments, mm-hmm. including a recent Chinese missile launch from the man-made structures,
sure.
and also a standoff between China and Vietnam over Chinese ongoing mm-hmm. geological survey work?
We're very concerned. We are lucky to have a brand new Assistant Secretary for East Asian Affairs, David Stilwell. Excuse me, I blanked on his name for a second. But yeah, David Still. And David has, he's a retired general, and he has so much region experience in the region. He has almost a lifelong career in the military spent there. He knows our allies. He understands the dynamic in the region. So we are incredibly lucky at the State Department to have a team of diplomats led by Assistant Secretary Stilwell, who are going to continue to work very closely on this issue as it relates to the South China Sea. It's important to note that the U.S. Navy operates in the Indo-Pacific on a daily basis. That's something that we've done for years. And of course, as it relates to international waters, we have the firm commitment that we will sail our boats and fly our planes in international waters in accordance to those laws wherever we deem necessary. We've always done that. We will continue to do that.
Last week, the Chinese officials complained and expressed deep concerns over a U.S. Navy ship sailing through the Taiwan Strait. What is your response? Is strengthening U.S.-Taiwan ties an irritant to U.S.-China relationship?
Well, we've had a long relationship, of course, with Taiwan. We recognize, you know, the many principles that China and Taiwan operate under. And we, of course, as you know, a few weeks ago, had the announcement of arms sales, which is in accordance to U.S. law. And that's something, a tradition that we continue. But again, as it relates to any movements by our ships, we, again, sail in international waters. We believe that freedom of navigation, freedom of the seas, wherever it may be, whether it is near China, near Taiwan, or, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere, in the Middle East, wherever it may be, freedom of navigation, freedom of the seas is something that is crucial to world prosperity, to world trade, and to American security. And so we will continue to operate by that mantra, of course, within everything that we do is within international law.
State Department spokeswoman Morgan Ortegas speaking with VOA's Nike Ching. Happening now in Asia, a Chinese government official has called on Hong Kong residents to oppose violence and accused some Western politicians of stirring unrest. The comments by Yang Guang followed a tense night in Hong Kong, where protesters defied riot police who pelted them with tear gas and rubber bullets. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. As we first reported in yesterday's program, a judge in Australia's Northern Territory has been accused of racism toward Indigenous defendants. We have more details, which Phil Mercer shares from Sydney.
Court transcripts published in the Australian media show Judge Greg Borchers accusing an Aboriginal woman of abandoning her children while drunk in that great Indigenous fashion. He also said that anthropologists might one day discover why Indigenous parents desert their children on such a regular basis. In another transcript, Judge Borchers told an Indigenous defendant who had dragged his partner through the house by her hair that he was just like a primitive person. The comments are now the subject of an official complaint and have been condemned by the Australian Law Society. Its president is Arthur Moses.
These comments are racist because they are disparaging, discriminatory and offensive, insulting and humiliating to Indigenous Australians based solely on their race.
It's not the first time Judge Borchers' comments in court have landed him in trouble. 2 years ago, there was a complaint after he told a young teenager that he was taking advantage of his mother's murder. The judge told investigators that there was no excuse for some of his remarks, but he said a heavy workload, dealing with cases involving violence and child abuse with no days off or counselling, had taken its toll. Judge Borchers has yet to publicly comment on the latest allegations. Indigenous Australians make up about 3% of Australia's population, but they account for more than a quarter of prison inmates. They also suffer higher rates of poverty and ill health and die, on average, 10 years before non-Aboriginal Australians. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, India's growing taste for chocolate. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, a leading member of the U.S. Congress is calling for the Trump administration to do more to mediate a dispute between two of America's closest allies in Asia, South Korea and Japan. Democrat Elliot Engel tells VOA the United States should not take sides in the dispute. We're on your side with the latest news and features at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, chocolate sales are booming in India, including in rural areas, which is why companies like Mondelez International and Nestle are investing more in the small but rapidly expanding market. Reuters correspondents Havovi Cooper and Siddharth Kavali unwrap the details.
Mamichi.
Across India, the young and old have a new craving, and it's for premium chocolates. And global chocolate makers are taking notice. Shopkeepers in cities and villages are now selling brands like Cadbury's Dairy Milk and Silk, which cost up to 170 rupees or nearly $2. Reuters correspondent Siddharth Kavle.
We are standing in front of Friend Store, whose owner Nitin tells me that they have started stocking Cadbury Silk. He says many people come in asking specifically for silks. And these are crowd that is a working class crowd, that is 25 and above.
And we have the right snack for every Indian.
As India's number one chocolate maker, Illinois-based Mondelez International, which owns Cadbury, is in a sweet spot, commanding 66% of the market, followed by Nestle and Ferrero. To retain its dominance, Mondelez told Reuters that the big bulk of a $150 million increase in global investment this year will be in rural India.
30% less sugar.
Mondelez is even introducing new products. Last month, it launched a low-sugar dairy milk bar, addressing a growing market for healthier products in India, where 9% of adults have diabetes. It has also been handing out free branded display coolers to shopkeepers and spending more on marketing with splashy Bollywood-style commercials.
This is where companies think their next market growth is, even faster than China. Last year, urban and rural consumers bought chocolates at a growth rate of 15.4%, which is one of the fastest growth markets all around the world.
While annual chocolate sales in India totaled $1.9 billion in 2018, it's still a fraction of the U.S. market for chocolates, which stands at a whopping $19.2 billion. But with a population nearly four times larger than the U.S., companies like Mondelez are betting that India's appetite for chocolates will continue to grow.
Reuters correspondents Havovi Cooper and Siddharth Karval. This news break from VOA Asia, tigers are one of the world's endangered species. India, however, is working hard to change that classification for its national animal. A new census of the big cats shows in just 4 years, India's tiger population has grown almost 30%, from 2,226 to 2,976. In 2010, India had just 1,400 tigers. You'll find all the big stories on VOA Asia Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, there's an allure and excitement to the power of an old-fashioned steam train. Coal-powered trains plied the rails in the United States for 175 years, starting in the 1830s following Chinese involvement in building early rail lines, and were an integral part of America's westward expansion and industrial revolution. Today, visitors can experience riding on America's oldest operating railroad, which is only 7 kilometers long. VOA's Deborah Block tells us more from Bronx, Pennsylvania.
The 1832 Strasburg Railroad keeps the feeling of yesteryear alive.
I like trains.
We really desire for people to come here and just experience early 20th century steam railroading like they would have back then.
Several powerful steam engines with restored wooden passenger cars provide 45-minute rides through the countryside. The railway is known as a short line. Short lines connected passengers and goods to a major railroad that traveled to bigger cities.
Back then, this was Strasbourg's connection to the outside world.
This first-class cabin reflects the opulence some could afford during that era.
Trains are such a part of the fabric of this country, in fact, a lot of nations in the world, so it's nice to go back and see how the trains operated.
It was fun to feel the sway back and forth and the slow pace.
Oh, it's fun, and I enjoy it because the scenery is so different, and it just takes you way back in time.
So does the nearby Railroad Museum of Pennsylvania, one of the largest U.S. train museums that tells the story of railroading in the Northeast.
We have around 100 pieces of full-size railroad equipment, passenger cars, steam locomotives, freight cars, but we also have smaller objects like uniforms that were worn by railroaders, dining car china and silver.
He says the big steam locomotives captivate people as much today as they did in the past.
Just the idea of something that powerful pulling many, many freight cars or passenger cars, which is something that always fascinated folks.
So did the caboose at the back of the train, which onlookers waved at as the train passed by, and keeping the nostalgia of the old trains alive.
I just like watching it. It's just fun, watching the scenery go by.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Bronx, Pennsylvania.
If it's July, and it is for at least the next 2 days, it must be time for a couple of championship races that typically do not make the headlines. But as Faith Lapidus reports, that doesn't matter to the contestants.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
This was the final sprint of the annual Diaper Derby, held in the lobby of a Midtown Manhattan hotel. The championship round brought together the winners of the earlier heats across the 3.7-meter-long course. Lucas Ho's parents were justifiably proud of their 14-month-old champion.
He was a late bloomer, starting to crawl, but usually he would come to food, so we just put food in front of him and he would just run straight to us. So it worked today. Blueberries did the trick.
Yeah, he's a hungry little bub.
On your mark. The Diaper Derby is sponsored by Lifetime Tribe, which hosts triathlon events around the United States.
This is a game of manipulation. The parents are dangling something, hoping to encourage the kids to crawl across the mat. Keys, cell phones, their favorite food, whatever it is.
The incentives don't always work. During the preliminary heats, some contestants wandered off. Others just plopped down and cried.
It is a slow race, right? This is the slowest 2 minutes in sport.
Maybe not.
Ready, steady, slow!
Because there's the annual World Championship Snail Race, held since the 1960s in Congham in the English county of Norfolk. The snails race, or slither, across a damp cloth spread out on a table, marked with three circles. The first one to reach the outer circle wins. Urged on by the exuberant crowd, some competitors tried to cheat. Some went the wrong way, and others held steady. But it was a nail-biter of a finish, and it's Sammy the Snail by an antenna.
I mean, I always believed he had it in him from the moment I met him earlier today. It's not what I expected to do with my Saturday, but, you know, really it's perhaps a new career for me in snail racing. Snail championships.
Championships which prove that slow and steady can win the race. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And we've apparently reached our circle. You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can also find us on many great radio stations across Asia, like Falcon Radio at Adamson University in the Philippines. We thank everyone there who's tuned into our program today, and we say hello to you. We also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day.